Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Maybe things really are turning around. Maybe they're just less bad, I don't know. Or maybe we're all just sick and tired of being sick and tired. Whatever the reason, we learned today we are starting to feel just a little bit better about the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society, ffyf.org. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at nextamericandream.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today is Tuesday, the 26th of May, and it's great to have you with us. I suppose today's news of a jump in consumer confidence is a tribute to the resilience of the American consumer, of their ability to find light in the economic darkness. It is one of those more squishy economic indicators. How are you feeling is the basic question. And based on answers to the most recent monthly survey, consumers are feeling better about things than they have in a while. Marketplace's Amy Scott is here to help us understand why that might be. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Kai.
I have to ask you, and let's just throw formalities out the window here, what is going on out there that people are feeling so much better?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, General Motors is on the verge of bankruptcy. We heard today that home prices fell another 18%+ in March. The unemployment rate appears to be on its way closer to 10%. But Kai, just to put things in perspective, in February, the Consumer Confidence Index hit an all-time low as people thought the economy was basically falling off a cliff. So today's reading is a lot better, but it's still a pretty pessimistic outlook in the scheme of things.
But the economy, as we have talked about, is getting bad less quickly, right? It's less worse.
That's right. I mean, the rate of job losses appears to be slowing slightly. Of course, people have been watching the stock market rally. And those of us in the media have been talking a lot about things getting less bad. I talked today to economist Joshua Shapiro at MFR, and he says consumers are getting the message.
People read newspapers, they listen to politicians and officials, and everybody has been on the same page on the sidelines, sort of cheerleading here. And I think people are looking for reasons to not be quite as depressed as they were, and they're latching onto this and saying, okay, things aren't that bad.
As Shapiro put it, we've moved from a sort of end-of-the-world confidence level to what you might see in a more typical economic slump. Shapiro, by the way, though, thinks that we have a long way to go before real optimism is justified.
But wait a second, because we will take fake optimism, right? Because part of this is if we feel better, then we'll spend money, which will make us feel better because there will be signs of economic recovery, right?
Well, that's the idea. And I did talk to one consumer spending expert today who says there's a lot of pent-up demand out there. You know, for a lot of the 90%+ of people who still have jobs, they may have more money in their pockets because they've been saving more. They're not spending as much on energy. But we haven't really seen a pickup in consumer spending yet. We did our own very unscientific poll here in New York. My colleague Raphael Cohen talked to folks at Grand Central Station and found that people aren't exactly ready to go shopping.
No, not really. I think that it's probably going to get worse before it gets better.
I'm being very conservative with my spending, and I'm being very conservative with how I'm looking at business.
In your own life, do you feel more confident about buying things and all this kind
of stuff? Not yet. No.
What's it going to take for that to change, I think?
About another 6 months.
That was Luke Nathan, Andrew Feinberg, and Diane Latinsky. And Kai, analysts say the correlation between the consumer confidence index and actual consumer spending is pretty iffy. So even a little bit of good news today is by no means a predictor.
And we'll have to track those people down in 6 months and figure out what they think, right? Especially that last
lady. That's right. See if she went shopping.
That's right. Amy Scott in New York. Thanks, Amy.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Traders take their good economic news where they can get it, squishy or not. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The subject readily at hand today in official Washington was, of course, the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. But as it's been for the past year or so, the subtext of a lot of the political discussions was the economy. Today, in particular, the financial system and how it ought to be regulated. A group led by a one-time Bush White House economic advisor and a commentator on this program named Glenn Hubbard weighed in today. Hubbard's group, the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation, it's called, said the Federal Reserve ought to be the one keeping an eye on threats to the financial system, not a panel of regulators. Of course, that presumes that anyone can see what's really going on inside the banking and finance industry, given some of the complicated rules that govern them. Things like the purchase accounting rule. As Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains now from New York, it's making bank earnings look a whole lot sweeter than they otherwise would.
First of all, in case purchase accounting isn't part of your daily vocabulary, here's an example from last fall.
Higher today, Washington Mutual failed last night. Federal regulators seized the bank and sold it to J.P. Morgan for just under $2 billion. Thought we'd run.
When that happened, J.P. Morgan was able to take advantage of an accounting rule and mark down all of the loans on WaMu's balance sheet. And now, as the market improves, J.P. Morgan can start marking those loans right back up again and make its own earnings look pretty great. Wells Fargo is doing the same with Wachovia's assets, and PNC is doing it with National City. Will Schwartz at the rating agency DBRS says each institution uses its own criteria to value the loans at the time of purchase.
They try to estimate, and obviously the institution is motivated to be as aggressive as possible, to mark down those assets upon closing and when they purchase the institution.
Schwartz says it's not cheating, it's just the way accounting rules work.
As long as people are aware of it and as long as there's disclosure, there shouldn't be a problem.
Joshua Ronan, an accounting professor at NYU, agrees, but he says,
I think we should approach this with professional skepticism. We should be careful to scrutinize these models. We don't have access to them as outside investors, but the auditors do.
Ronan says it's up to those auditors to keep shareholders well informed so they can tell the difference between good earnings and an accounting trick. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Every month, Standard & Poor's releases something called the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And every month for the past year and a half or so, it has shown a pretty steep decline in home prices. Today, well, the same thing, even as everybody keeps expecting some kind of a bottom. Tamara Keith reports that could be a while.
Decline in home prices is slowing down, slightly. As one economist put it, instead of falling off a cliff, now they're just rolling down a very steep hill. Maureen Maitland is a vice president at Standard & Poor's.
There really aren't many regions that are going unscathed. Some are down tremendously, some are horribly affected, others are mildly affected, but it seems like almost every market is in fact affected.
Basically, all those steady home value gains in the last 5 years or so, on average, nationally, they're gone.
Home prices are back down to their late 2002 levels. That basically means we've lost all of the increases that went on between 2002 and 2006.
The decline in home prices is not over.
So this isn't the bottom, says Peter Morisi. The University of Maryland business professor says foreclosures are going to continue. Job losses will make the problem worse. That'll make it tough for home prices to bottom out or increase.
Defaults are now going to hit all elements of the housing market. The prime borrowers, the subprime borrowers, people Alt-A's in between. And going forward, the go-go days are over.
Even once home sales turn around, Morisi says we're not going to be able to bank on big gains in home values like we did just a few years ago. Something other than housing is going to have to pull us out of this recession. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Although the immediate fear of a global swine flu pandemic has quieted, the aftershocks of the early stage of the outbreak are still spreading. Farmers in the southeast are having a hard time finding enough migrant labor to work their fields this year. The virus has created backlogs on both sides of the border that are keeping legal migrants idle. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
They may look like any other root vegetable, but sweet potatoes are a labor-intensive crop.
They're transplanted by hand, and then they're harvested by hand.
That's Sue Johnson Langdon with the North Carolina Sweet Potato Commission. She says this year there aren't enough workers to do the transplanting. After the swine flu outbreak, Mexico closed its immigration offices,
which is where the workers get their travel visas and their work documents and get documented in order to enter the country.
There have been no reported cases of legal migrant workers with swine flu. Mexico has since reopened its immigration offices, and migrant workers have begun to trickle into sweet potato, lettuce, and tobacco fields. But the delay has left many U.S. farmers scrambling. Tony Acion is with the Latino advocacy group El Pueblo. He says the virus made the immigration process tougher for workers and for farmers.
They want to do everything on the up and up and not hire undocumented workers. But the reality is that they don't have enough people to work. And as a result, they may very well lose a big chunk of their crops.
And that, in turn, could end up costing us more at the grocery store. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Nearly a million people die of malaria every year, most of them young children in sub-Saharan Africa. A public-private venture that includes $200 million from the Gates Foundation is working on a vaccine. It's about to do its final tests. And if that vaccine works, the collaboration that produced it could offer a viable business model for developing drugs for poorer countries. Megan Williams reports now from Gabon in Central Africa.
Dr. Maxime Agnaji peers into a microscope at the Albert Schweitzer Hospital in Lambourini, Gabon.
I'm trying to detect some specific population of oocyte cells.
The 35-year-old, who grew up in the country, heads the research unit here as part of the biggest medical trial ever held in Africa, a malaria vaccine test involving 16,000 kids and 11 different research centers across the continent.
Basically, I want to stay here to develop my career here.
Agnaji is one of the principal investigators for the final test of the vaccine, called RTSS. So far, it's been shown to cut the rate of severe malarial infection by half. Agnaji says it's not only exciting to work on a solution to a mainly African problem, but on a project that's changing the face of medical research in Africa.
Since the 10 last years, there is improvement in training in to control diseases. I met many, many doctors from different countries. All are from Africa now, young researchers from Africa.
The Gates Foundation decided to invest in the malaria vaccine research after scientists at the drug company, GlaxoSmithKline, showed it had real potential. But for big drug companies, vaccines in Africa just aren't profitable. People are too poor to pay. Without the Gates funding, the malaria vaccine wouldn't have been developed. Rip Ballou of the Gates Foundation has been part of the quest for a malaria vaccine for more than two decades.
If you go back 20 years, most research being done in Africa was being done by Europeans and Americans who came here because there's all these disease challenges, fascinating problems, but there was no resources coming from the African host nations.
Unlike most drug trials in Africa, the bulk of the funding has been invested right here, in Africa. By building first-rate hospitals and labs and upgrading facilities and equipment to Western standards. And, of course, developing motivated scientists like Dr. Maxime Agnaji.
You know, I think one of the great things that's happened with this program over the last several years is that we've identified a whole cadre of really talented African investigators to do this.
If this last trial of the RTSS vaccine proves effective, then in a few years comes the next hurdle, making it affordable to the people who so desperately need it. GlaxoSmithKline is contractually obliged by the Gates Foundation to set a ceiling on the price, but it can also make a profit. Joe Cohen is the GlaxoSmithKline scientist who invented the vaccine. He insists low cost is a priority.
It makes sense. You know, this malaria vaccine, in contrast to many other vaccines, is exclusively meant for African children. There is no other market for it. It would be crazy for us, after 25 years of work on malaria vaccine, to do anything that would prevent this vaccine from being accessible and to see this vaccine just sitting on a shelf.
In Lambourini, Gabon, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Coming up, climate change and economic competition.
There is the potential for people to press for trade measures, for example, tariffs against steel, under the guise of leveling the climate playing field.
But first, let's do the numbers. That surge in consumer confidence we told you about really boosted Wall Street's confidence. Dow Industrials advanced 196 points, 2.3%, finished at 8,473. The Nasdaq jumped 58 points, nearly 3.5%, closed at 1,750. The S&P 500 climbed 23 points, 2.2%, wrapped up trading at around 910. The market effectively shrugged off that discouraging Case-Shiller report on still tumbling home prices. Shares of home builder Toll Brothers managed a gain of more than 2%. Home Depot stock rose more than 4% today. About 9 were up for every 1 down stock that was on the New York Stock Exchange today. Apple shares booted up close to 7% today. Stock in Macy's climbed almost 6%. Zions Bancorp jumped 14%. An analyst upgraded that stock. Lower bond prices pushed the 10-year T-notes yield up 3.55%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for April. The Global Health Council's 36th annual conference continues in the nation's capital. And on May 27, 1937, the Golden Gate Bridge opened. Pedestrians could cross on that day. Cars had to wait one more day to drive over the San Francisco landmark. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with the CEO of Fiat today. The Italian car company is one of four bidders for Opel. That's the troubled German subsidiary of the equally troubled General Motors. Also in the running for Opel are the Canadian auto parts company Magna, the European private equity group RHJ International, and a late entry from China, the Beijing Automotive Industry Corporation. The German government holds another meeting tomorrow to pick a lucky winner, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The formal decision will be made in America. GM and the U.S. administration will give their blessing to the successful suitor. But in effect, it's the German government that will really decide, because the Germans have put together a kind of dowry, a package of loan guarantees for Opel worth over $2 billion. David Bailey of Coventry University Business School.
The German government is providing the cash to make sure that any bidder can continue in business. So German government is looking at how many jobs will be safeguarded in Germany and whether plants will be kept open in Germany.
There are 25,000 German jobs at stake, and with a general election later this year, that's a particularly sensitive issue. It may dash Fiat's hopes of winning the prize. Professor Ferdinand Dudenhofer is with Duisburg University. He says the fact that Fiat is a rival European car maker is a disadvantage.
We have the fear that Fiat has to cut more jobs because Fiat and Opel has both overcapacities and they are in the same market area.
The Belgian-based investment firm RHJ seems a non-runner, and the Chinese contenders thought to have entered the race too late. That, says Dudenhofer, leaves the Canadian car part maker Magna.
I think Magna has the best chances, and Magna will be the preferred bidder for Opel.
Magna has no plants already in Europe. It'll pump in $1 billion of its own money and has pledged to create more jobs. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Chinese aren't only interested in buying up parts of American car companies, as in that bid for Opel. Just this weekend, we learned a group of Chinese investors has signed on to buy 15% of basketball's Cleveland Cavaliers, home to MVP LeBron James, and this year dreams of an NBA championship. Commentator Sean Ryan says China's new business strategy of going after foreign brands is a good thing.
Every day there are new rumors of Chinese companies' acquisition plans, like Chinese automakers Chery's possibly bailing out Detroit by buying the troubled Volvo and Saab brands from Ford and GM. Sound familiar? It should. The Japanese did the same thing in the 80s when they purchased American icons such as Pebble Beach and Rockefeller Center, inspiring fear that everyone would soon be working for the land of the rising sun. China's purchasing power is raising similar concerns, but the similarities end there. The Chinese approach is very different from Japan's. Why? Because the Chinese have very different goals. While the Japanese were quick to install glass ceilings for foreign managers in their companies and capture assets on the cheap, the Chinese are making acquisitions specifically to get management experience and expertise. They want strategic access to natural resources, and they need to acquire valuable brands and marketing know-how, since China does not yet have truly global brands like Japan's Sony and Toyota. For instance, when Chinese computer maker Lenovo acquired IBM's ThinkPad line, they installed an American CEO and gave American engineers prominent positions in the combined company. Chinese companies want to learn from the companies they acquire, unlike the Japanese, who believe their management systems are far superior to America's. The U.S. should view China, with its $2 trillion in foreign reserves and appetite for T-bills, more as a lifeline than a potential enemy superpower. As the most influential participants in global institutions like the UN and the G20, China and America are the linchpins for worldwide economic recovery. Injecting Chinese capital into American industry is part of the solution, not the problem.
Sean Ryan is managing director of the China Market Research Group. We welcome your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. If you follow the debate over climate change, you're about to start hearing and reading a lot of news coming out of Copenhagen, Denmark. The UN is having a conference there in December that it hopes will replace the Kyoto Treaty of a decade ago. In Copenhagen today, a group of international business CEOs laid down their marker for that conference: deep cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, preferably by limiting carbon pollution and then letting companies buy and sell pollution quotas. Congress is debating a climate change bill that uses the same basic idea. Cap and trade is the shorthand. But for companies that might have to operate within cap and trade rules, when their foreign competition in, say, China won't have to, it's a much longer story, one that could see the fight against climate change turn into a green trade war. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Many business leaders say the costs of cracking down on greenhouse gases will put America's already struggling manufacturers at a competitive disadvantage. Those that can make their products more cheaply abroad will simply move to countries that don't limit emissions, says Kevin Carnes of the U.S. Business and Industry Council.
They'll move to China, so they take advantage of cheap electricity from these filthy coal-fired plants in China, and they'll supply the American market from these locations.
That would mean fewer jobs here at home. But no country likes the scenario of polluting competitors undercutting prices in their home market, says Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Countries say, well, if we're going to take measures, we have to do something at the border to prevent the same product being produced abroad and just imported by our country. So those thoughts trigger potential for trade wars.
So lawmakers have added a provision to the greenhouse gas legislation that echoes the European Union's approach. It gives energy-intensive companies like steelmakers, chemical plants, and paper mills the right to demand tariffs on imports if, after 5 years, they can prove unfair carbon competition.
On the surface, that seems fairly reasonable, but it won't necessarily be seen as so reasonable by others.
Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations says trading partners and domestic importers of cheap foreign materials, say car parts, fear the climate tariffs are ripe for abuse.
There is the potential for people to press for trade measures, for example, tariffs against steel, under the guise of leveling the climate playing field, but really for more base protectionist purposes.
Supporters of the tariff allowances in the climate change bill, like Kevin Carnes of the U.S. Business and Industry Council, are particularly worried about imports from China and other developing countries.
The developing world, and China is, I don't think, part of that anymore because it's come so far so fast, they're perfectly happy to pollute, take subsidies from foreigners to help with their environmental problems, etc. But they'll be the first to yelp if there's anything in the new legislation that might be considered a subsidy.
Such as a tariff. Environmentalists claim these worries about Chinese advantages are exaggerated. China, they say, is already imposing stiffer appliance standards and installing cleaner coal-burning technology. And when it comes to intensive greenhouse gas-emitting imports, like steel and chemicals and cement, the Council on Foreign Relations' Michael Levy says China's not the problem anyway.
Most energy-intensive U.S. imports do not come from China. They do not come from India. They come from Canada, from the European Union. They come from places where we should be expecting fairly significant measures to cut emissions. So the competitiveness question really gets shrunk by that.
Countries that either already limit emissions or plan to won't face any tariffs. And there are no advantages to domestic companies looking to sidestep cleanup costs by moving to those countries. All sides say the easiest way to avoid a green trade war is to negotiate a global pollution agreement that sets the same emission limits on all countries equally. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and its 57th Annual Management Conference with faculty debating the future of markets. May 29th, chicagobooth.edu. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a lesson in the law of diminishing returns for the folks who run Facebook. A Russian investment group has coughed up $200 million for a nearly 2% stake in the company. Do the math, and that works out to an overall value of about $10 billion for the social networking site. It is the second high-profile pot of cash Facebook has gotten. 2 years ago, Microsoft bought in for $240 million. Its slice led to a pre-recession total value of $15 billion for all of Facebook. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 196 points, 2.3%. The NASDAQ added 58 points, almost 3.5%. The S&P 500 gained 23 points, 2.2%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. Coming up next time on this broadcast, stores open in odd places and encourage you to buy, buy, and buy.
This is a special event. It's one time only. You have to go out of your way to get here. It's very special. It's temporary.
All right, I'm sold. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.